holograms are an abstract expression of the completeness. In other words, it's like the level of hermetic silence on the eighth. The real dynamic process is a pair of threes, and that's why there are hexagrams. Six. Now, without understanding this little trigger, Taoism, the I Ching, and in fact the whole connection between modern physics and ancient Chinese thought is lost. We'll take a break in just a few minutes. Am I going too fast? So the connection needs to be seen with the inner eye. And the connection is this. Whenever there is an exchange of centers, a single occurrence comes into being. Now we call that a synthesis, but our language, our English usage of synthesis now in the 20th century is filled with an anti-Hegelian bias, which was not there in the English use of the term, say, about 200 years ago, or even 100 years ago. The original early 19th century use of the term synthesis is what is actually meant here. Synthesis in the sense that what now occurs is something on its own. Something on its own. It exists in its own right. It's like the classic esoteric statement of a marriage, hieros gamos. What heaven has brought together, let no man put asunder. Because this is something in its own right. It's no longer two, but it's one. But it's even more profound than that. It's one that's zero-based. And so to a Taoist, there is a Tao in the synthesis that was mysteriously invisible when there was just one thing, but when two things come together, when the pairedness comes together, the Tao is more manifest. It's easier for man to see. Now notice, in a binary system, the Tao is present every time you use it. You don't have to make the binary, the one and the zero, add up finally to something which is Tao. Every time you use it, you're using one and zero together in its pairedness, and the Tao is always occurring. So the Chinese classical sense is that there is a flavor of mystery to the real. And to the Chinese Taoist, what is important is to be able to taste the mystery all the time. And if you can taste the mystery all the time, then whatever key you need is there. Whatever. This person who is able to do this is no longer a man, but is a spirit, is a Shen, is someone who is free in the Tao. So that, let's look down here at the bottom of the page. Heaven's stability is five, Earth's stability is four, but man's stability is nine, the meeting of heaven and earth together. Man's stability is in a nine-fold symbolic form in esoteric primordial Chinese thought. And in order to show this to you, if you just turn the page, you can see here a Chinese Tibetan mandala that has the zodiac on the outside, the trigrams on the middle, and in the very center, a nine-part magic square. And this is exactly true. This is an extremely fine, basic symbolic example. Now man, in his intelligent living exists on this middle ecology where the trigrams are. And heaven's ecology is in that zodiacal continuum. But the quintessential core is there in the magic square in the center. So that the Taoist seeks not just to work with the I Ching and the trigrams and the hexagrams, but tries to emancipate himself from having to use the book at all. What does he use? He uses himself. And a real accomplished Taoist never consults the I Ching at all. Ever. Which I suppose would shock some of the Swiss psychiatrists. Let's take a break. Is John okay?
John, are you here?
Yeah.
Is he under the call?
And Donna, is she?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Good. From what we said this morning, you can appreciate how important it was to the Chinese to conceive of motion from the center, that the center in its health guarantees the fact that your life, your actions are integral. And so the Chinese name for themselves, the middle country. And so you can imagine in the Han Dynasty, the later, early part of the later Han Dynasty, around the beginning of the 2nd century AD, when the merchants in the south of China, not too far from where Canton is now, the merchants coming from India were talking about the great religion of the Middle Way, about Buddhism. And it seemed perfectly natural to the Chinese disposition that the religion of the Middle Way was exactly what they had always done, and so Buddhism must be theirs. So one of the great anomalies of history, Buddhism is the only foreign ideational power to ever be accepted in Chinese civilization. That's because of this peculiar quality of the Middle Way, of Buddhism. Because in fact, Buddhism only works if it works on the Middle Way. The extremes don't work in Buddhism at all. That's how you know that you're not on the path. The original theosophical path is an understanding of the Middle Way in Buddhism, esoteric understanding. The path only exists when you are there and not indulging in extremes. The more that you indulge in extremes, the less the path occurs at all. It's not that it doesn't exist, it's even more profound than that. Its non-existence also doesn't occur. So that there is no such thing as being unconsciously on the path. And in Buddhism, the understanding, for instance, like in the Vajrayana, the understanding of an avisi hell is that you're in a life space where the path doesn't occur at all. This is like really being damned, like really being lost, because there is no possibility whatsoever. And that one can be saved out of a situation where there's no possibility is just showing the spontaneous, protean, mysterious power of the real. So the Chinese understanding of themselves becomes a key for our understanding of ourself. Why? Because the synthesizing idea in the 20th century is a cosmology which unites nuclear physics and galactic astronomy together. And for us to follow the Western way, the Western path to understanding that would require of us to understand celestial dynamics in a mathematical way. There's no way around that. So that Eastern wisdom, in particular, quintessentially Chinese Taoist wisdom, is a bona fide shortcut for modern Western man to understand the situation of his civilization that came out of purely Western development. It's very, very peculiar. A couple of years ago, the Bollingen edition of the I Ching had sold over 2 million copies. No copies in China. All these 2 million copies are in Western, mostly American and Western European countries. I remember one time, I think it was 70 or 71, I was helping to host a whole visiting entourage in Canada, an entourage of Chinese engineers. There were some 45 of them. They all wore jet black with just the little red star on the lapel at the time. They all had close cropped, usually gray hair, butch haircuts. And they were visiting Calgary, Alberta, where I was teaching at the time, on a Petroleum Institute exchange. And as part of the entertainment, I thought it'd be interesting to set an I Ching out. They didn't relate to it at all. None of them, and they were all very intelligent men, had ever seen an I Ching. Had no idea. No idea. And these were the makers and shakers of one of the gut industries of modern China. I mean, petroleum products are one of the cores of modern industrial civilization. They didn't relate to it at all. But you can't set an I Ching down in a coffee clutch anywhere in the Western world without somebody saying, oh, gee, I'd like to look at that. See? It's like one of my my old friends, Jacob Needleman, said, the Taoists are in the West in the 20th century. They're not in China. It's a very peculiar quality, because if you take a close look at the way in which Western psychological therapies have evolved, the blind spot is exactly there where Chinese Taoism and nuclear physics and galactic astronomy is. In fact, when I was lecturing on the alchemical core of Jung's work at the PRS and did a 13-part series a year or two ago, I showed in Jung's correspondence exactly where he says that Western psychological therapeutic techniques don't work for Chinese people because they don't have an unconscious. I mean, it's glaring inconsistency. An empirical scientist should have looked at that and said, wait a minute, how can this be? You see. In fact, the psyche, Jung notes in one of the letters, the psyche of the European is easily graded down to the unconscious. They're like steps. He uses the simile that you open a cellar door and walk down the steps into the basement. But from someone in the New World, you open that door and there's a free fall for quite a ways until you hit bottom. But in the Chinese psyche, you open that door and there's free fall forever. And there's no fear. It's an anomaly that betrays a skewed mentality, a kind of a distorted mind, which Western civilization most certainly has, that makes it impossible to recover health, because the techniques, the methods, which would be used by that mind, are always going to lead to this kind of flattened skew. Which is why Westerners who take up Asian philosophies in a matter of 10 or 15 or 20 years usually denude it, squeeze out all the juice, and end up even more disillusioned than ever. There's nothing more boring than a Westerner who's done Zen for 20 years. That's sad. They end up watching John Wayne movies on video. What is the key in reversing that kind of sad scenario? The key is that experience, rather than consciousness, is the foundation. Experience is the foundation. And experience integrates. The universal quality of experience is that it integrates. You don't have to make it integrate. It already has that kind of a bias. It has that asymmetry that it tends to come together. Whereas consciousness, in a symmetrical way, has the asymmetry of it tends to differentiate. It tends to radiate. So when you find someone who is, if you could find someone who is really conscious, they would be radiant. Then they would be disinterested in integration. A very, very, very strange thing. So our situation in our education, our unfolding pattern, needs to be founded on experience, needs to be founded on nature, but in such a way that nature yields a primordial occurrence, horizon, called ritual. You don't have to fear being trapped by ritual or being sucked into some kind of ritualistic this or that. That's not it at all. Our working definition of ritual is what you do. And one of the great insights that we have is the development of anthropology in the 20th century. I don't mean just in the 20th century, but in the early 20th century, the first half of the 20th century. Because most of the advances in anthropology, it's the only science that has this characteristic, most of the advances were made by women. Early 20th century anthropology is a feminine science and has an insight penetration quality, which almost no other science has, and we need to be informed about that. And it isn't just a question of reading Margaret Mead's books. There's a whole range of women. One of the great unsung geniuses there is a woman named Mary Douglas, which you probably have never heard of. One of her great books was called Natural Symbols. Another one of her books is called Purity and Danger, Applying Anthropological Investigative Techniques to Housework. Mm-hmm. And you find that contemporary human beings, urban contemporary human beings, are extremely superstitious, extremely prone to a kind of black magic, extremely culpable to all kinds of witch doctrine, just like quote, savage barbarian tribespeople used to be thought of in Victorian times. The really barbaric primitives now are urban human beings who have no culture, have no tradition, and have no ability to see how experience integrates and comes together. They need more than ever to get some real help. In a way, the inner urban city in the Western world is the only Avisi hell that exists. Let's turn over to our second page where we have this diagram. And we'll come to this next week, but notice that the zodiac level here, this zodiac level, eventually we'll be able to see that this leads to the textbook that we have, Galaxies. This inner core where the magic square is eventually leads to nuclear physics. And where the trigrams are, this eventually leads to what we're talking about, anthropology. So that there are levels here which the Chinese tradition keeps in good display. In other words, keeps in a kind of a display where the distinction of horizons is accurate all the way through all the levels of evolution and development. So that you have if you had a cross section of this mandala, that would be the synthesizing idea. That would be the cosmological line. And what we're trying to get to after 2 years is to be able to see in our own lives, in our own persons, in the very fact of our existence, to see how that line is manifesting or is not manifesting. And that is that's the center line on which the architecture of the person in our time can be made. Now the third page that's here, I took some material from A History of Chinese Philosophy by Feng Yulan, published by Princeton University Press, and I thought you might like to see some of the correlations that are here. If you read through this page, you'll be able to understand that the 10 heavenly stems have to do with the pairing of the 5. I'll let you do that on your own. Let's turn to the fourth page. Here is here's a couple of pages from the Authentic I Ching, published by my old friend Al Saunders over in the Valley, Newcastle Books, by Henry Wei, MD, PhD, MA. And you can read through this particular, I've added here matrix and cycle so that you can see that the hexagrams of the I Ching occur in two different orders, as a square matrix or as a circular cycle. And you can read through here and see how binary mathematics, how a binary arithmetic progression works its way out. And you can see here that it runs all the way from 0000000 to 111111, and the progression holds for the hexagram. I'll let you read that on your own. Let's turn to the last page, and the last page is in answer to the last paragraph that was on the preceding page. Henry Wei wrote, "It will be noted that in the circular arrangement, any two diagonally opposite hexagrams always represent two figures which add up to 63. In other words, if you do a cross section of the circular cycle of the hexagrams in this progression, in this order, this binary progression, they always add up to 63, not to 64. They don't add up to a static 64. There's no sense of completeness. They add up to a 63, which gives a little bit of input to the ongoingness of the progression.
Mm-hmm.
Always. So notice the Taoist trigger here, again, that subtle but indispensable realization that what is happening counts. So that when you're using the mind to think, you have to also use your spirit to be aware that you are thinking and that that's what's happening. So that whatever thought comes to understand, it has to nudge itself over just a little bit to the real. So there's always an emendation, even to the perfect thought. Otherwise, you're going to fill that gap with fantasy. That's what the Gnostics do. You're going to think that there's something beyond all this. There's something unknown out there. And indeed, and it's not only unknown out there, it's not knowable always in what's happening. And if you take that into account, you don't have to go into a kind of a mythology of evil. You can go into a life of radiance. Now, this sounds like 3rd century AD esotericism. It is. It was well understood in the 3rd century. We lost it in the 4th century in the Western tradition. We lost it because simply everybody who talked about it was killed. By 365 AD, that's where the Nag Hammadi materials were buried, because you would be killed if you were found carrying them. This kind of material was not only burned, it was rooted out. And anyone who talked about these ideas, two generations later, the most elegant, beautiful, intelligent woman in the world, Hypatia, talked to her esoteric students in Alexandria, of all places, about this sort of thing. And they turned on her. They murdered her with their pens. Not just killed her, but stripped the flesh from the bones. Why? Because of this savage scapegoat hatred for somebody who's manifesting the mysterious that shouldn't be talked about, shouldn't be manifested. In other words, stupidity can go to the surreally ignorant quality of horror and terror. Well, later on, when we get to mythology, we'll take a look at Mircea Eliade's great book on the myth of the eternal return and see that the complement, the other side to the myth of eternal return, is the terror of history. So there's a lot of serious things to tend to. It isn't all simple. But by keeping ourselves concentrated and dynamic and going on with it, we weight our sense of development to the real. And that's why this particular course runs in a 2-year cycle. Because when you weight something for a whole year, you have to counterbalance it by undoing it for a whole year. But you keep the same dynamic. But it has a kind of a twist like a Mobius strip has. It looks like it has reversed, but what it's doing is simply following the other side. Consciousness, in a way, is the other side of experience. When you're there in your experience, there's no consciousness. When you're there in consciousness, there's no experience. Usually we're in between, and there are both. But there are states where one can have pure consciousness with no experience whatsoever, or one can have pure experience with no consciousness whatsoever. They do occur, just as there are hexagrams for this. the state where there's pure experience with no consciousness would be of the hexagram that has the six yin lines. And for consciousness, the six yin lines. There are those hexagrams. They exist. Notice how the genius of the primordial Chinese tradition accepts these two extremes into, factors them into an ongoing cyclic order, which has also 58 other possibilities. There are some esoteric things here. Anyway, at the end, Henry Wei writes, "What is mysterious and mystifying is this. Why is it that the arrangement of the 64 hexagrams, whether circular or square, created by the legendary sage Fu Shi more than 5,000 years ago, can be transformed into 64 consecutive numbers in the binary system conceived by Leibniz in the 18th century?" Well, the answer to that is on the last page. And actually, he conceived it not in the 18th century, but in the 17th century, because he was in Amsterdam in the 1660s, and even though he was only 20 years old, Leibniz, 20 years old, is already formidable. He was holding conversations with Spinoza. And when Spinoza and Leibniz got together, that was about 75% of the intelligence of the whole city. Some Jesuit priests had brought back some clumsy Latin translation of the I Ching, and it was there in Amsterdam, and Leibniz had access to it and saw right away that this was a key that he was looking for. So Leibniz's book, which was not published and not printed for 300 years, if you can imagine. You wonder what's wrong with the West? Because we squander our own tradition. We don't even use it. We use less than a trace element of our own tradition. Don't get me started. I can hardly believe it. The University of Hawaii Press, though, excellent as they are, published in 1977 in this Monographs of the Society for Asian and Comparative Philosophy, they published Leibniz's Discourse on the Natural Theology of the Chinese, made a nice translation of it. And so I reprinted pages 158 and 159 for you, and you can read in translation Leibniz's own words here. Let's start at the beginning here. "Centuries later have all sought therein philosophical mysteries. Others have even wanted to extract from them a sort of geomancy and other follies." And this is still going on, as you know. "Actually, the 64 figures represent a binary of arithmetic, which apparently this great legislator Fu Shi possessed, and which I have rediscovered some thousands of years later." In other words, Leibniz in the 1660s did what Jung did in the 1920s. He had incredible genius insights and no way to know whether they were true or not, whether they made any sense, until he looked, both Jung and Leibniz looked at Chinese examples, and both of them looked at the same thing. They both looked at the I Ching. And the I Ching mirrored back in pristine symbolic form the essential structure of the idea which both Leibniz in 1660 and Jung in 1920 had. What is the idea? That the psyche is an ordered single pattern. Therefore, all expressions of the psyche, if you could map them all out, would all have relationships to a single center. What makes calculus a science, for instance, is the fact that every expression of any development and any application of calculus operates on the same synthesizing principle. And the same thing in Hume, in his commentary to The Secret of the Golden Flower, you can see psychic energy has a center. No matter how powerful it is, no matter how protean it becomes, it still has a center. But that the center is a focus and not something. The mistake of thinking that the center is a thing is a purely egotistical projection. That's the kind of sloppy approximation that the ego has. So that let's follow Leibniz a little bit more. Fauchy knew that which I have rediscovered some thousands of years later. In binary arithmetic, there are only two signs, 0 and 1, with which one can write all numbers. When I communicated this system to the Reverend Father Bouvet, he recognized in it the characters of Fauchy, for the numbers 0 and 1 correspond to them exactly. If we put a broken line for 0 and an unbroken line for the unity 1, this arithmetic furnishes the simplest way of making changes. Notice that every word here in Leibniz's writing 330 years ago is just full of insight. How excellent he was. Since there are only two components, concerning which I wrote a small essay in my early youth, which was reprinted a long time afterwards against my will, so it seems that Fauchy had insight into the science of combinations. Now, to pause here for a moment, because you may not have this background, the whole development of Western thought received in the late 12th century a quantum jump forward because the Hermetic tradition came back into play in Western civilization. And when it came back into play, there were two geniuses on a level with Leibniz who were there to translate that Hermetic tradition into a whole myriad of workings of techniques and ideas and intelligent applications and so forth. Those two individuals were Roger Bacon and Raymond Lull. And Raymond Lull works are just now being translated after 800 years. Princeton, again, is putting out the collected writings and two volumes of Raymond Lull. His archetypal treatise was The Art of Combination, a whole series of numbered wheels of expressions that were interrelated so that one could begin to understand reality in terms of its correlation to the human psyche, which of course is one of the great mainstays of the Hermetic tradition. Roger Bacon, I'm sure that most of you realize, is the great developer of alchemy and many other things. Roger Bacon is the first man to ever make a magnifying glass, and he also made a telescope. Only his telescope was made 400 years before Galileo. There just wasn't any cultural possibility of anybody tying into it at the time. We have, in some of Roger Bacon's manuscripts, we have drawings, for instance, of incredible structures which were not recognized until the 20th century. There's a drawing of the way in which spermatozoa penetrate an egg, drawn 700 years before anybody had a microscope powerful enough to be able to see this. But if you have a penetrating insight and you know what a progression is, you can, in your imagination, in your creative imagination, follow it through to its ultimate form. It's a yogic principle, incidentally. So Leibniz writes here that so it seems that Fu Shi had insight into the science of combinations, but the arithmetic having been completely lost, later Chinese have not taken care to think of them in this arithmetic way, and they have made of these characters of Fu Shi some kind of symbols and hieroglyphs, as one customarily does when one has strayed from the true meaning, as the good Father Kircher has done with respect to the script of the Egyptian obelisks, of which he understands nothing. This is Kircher. You usually see the name Kircher, Athenaeus Kircher, and he was a great Jesuit magus who collected tomes and tomes and tomes of esoteric lore and then put it together in one grand synthesis that was sort of like Monty Python's idea of the cosmos. Incredible. Mrs. Hall uses the German term Quatsch, meaning garbage. He simply didn't understand. And so by using fantasy as the glue, you can make all kinds of chimera. And because it's all the same quality of chimera, it seems to make sense. But it only makes sense as long as you're following along in the garbage. And as soon as you get out of the garbage truck, or as Fritz Perls used to say, as soon as you get out of the garbage pail, you realize you need another cigarette. That it's a whole different show. It's different. So Leibniz is now saying that the Chinese, the later Chinese, did not understand their own origins, forgot them. Now this shows also that the ancient Chinese have surpassed the modern ones in the extreme, not only in piety, which is the basis of the perfect, most perfect morality. Now what is this piety? Piety is inner concentration. Leibniz is the great inheritor of the Rosicrucian synthesis. He's the hermetic master of that age. He was the grand master of that age. And when he uses the term piety here, it's like an inner yoga. They meant it in a Christian, Protestant-Christian kind of a way here. If you get interested in this, I have all the literature on this here. Anyway, the Chinese, modern Chinese, have not understood, and they lost the piety, but they lost the science as well. And so, this little pamphlet that I handed out to you today represents an insight for us. What is this insight? The insight is that the reason why we're using the I Ching, and the reason why we're using the Tao of Physics, is because there is a spiritual recognition that's still scintillating in the Chinese tradition that we can appreciate. It isn't like we're trying to appropriate something from an alien culture and put foreign ideas from alien people into our domestic psyche at all. It's that the quintessential core of our own psyche that has been blurred and covered up through a flaw in Western mind has come to recognize progressively, at first in a few geniuses like Leibniz or Jung, but now in a broad cultural superhighway, that there's gold in these hills. And the gold is inner recognition from ourselves. There's something in our own psyches that comes alive vis-a-vis this material. So this is nourishment for us. In particular, the nourishment is in exactly the range of appreciating cosmology. What does all this mean? How did we get, why are we here? Whatever reason could there be? How does it happen? Not just how does it happen in a tell me a story, but what is the specifics of the whole detailed process, which we now understand, now know. We know that, for instance,